Hey y'all, it's Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. I'm a board-certified gynecologist, a clinical assistant professor of OBGYN at Northwestern Feinberg School of Medicine, and owner of a private practice for almost a decade that specializes in menopause and sexual medicine. I'm a South Asian American Muslim woman who is here to empower, educate, and help you advocate for health issues that have been stigmatized, shamed, and perhaps even prevented you from living your best life. I'm better than your best girlfriend and more open than most of your doctors. I'm here to educate so you can advocate. Welcome to Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. Let's go. Hey guys, it's me, Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. Have you guys heard that song? I don't like no whips and chains and you can't tie me down, but you can whip your lovin' on me. You can whip your lovin' on me. So if you've heard this song by Jack Harlow, you know that, when you listen to the words about choking, you know that rough sex is pretty pervasive in the media, in what we read, in what we sing. And so if we're hearing it, you can bet your kids are too. And so I wanted to introduce this next podcast that I did with the awesome Dr. Debbie Herbernick. She is an amazing researcher at Indiana University. She's a provost professor at the School of Public Health and director of the Center for Sexual Health Promotion, has done tons of research in the last 25 years and is always quoted for some of her research. And she wrote a book that was published in November called Yes, Your Kid, What Parents Need to Know About Today's Teens and Sex, Plus How to Talk to Your Child About Communication, Consent, Sexting, and Pornography. So I think that you guys are really going to get some good information today and understand that some rough sex practices are very pervasive and they have consequences. Just like anything else in life, there are consequences to what we do. There are risks and benefits to everything we talk about. And here I am just wanting to educate you so you could advocate for yourself in whatever realm that you can. So tune in for this podcast. You're going to love it with Dr. Debbie Herbernick, and we talk about the rise of rough sex practices and choking and strangulation and what you should know about your kids and how to talk to them about it. So let's get at it. Hey, y'all. It's me, Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. I'm so excited today to bring you guys another episode of Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. Today, I have a very special guest, and I'm excited for you to hear from her, Dr. Debbie Herbernick. She is an amazing researcher and clinician. She is a provost professor at the Indiana University School of Public Health in Bloomington, Indiana. She's a director of the Center for Sexual Health Promotion and an ASEX-certified sexuality educator. Her new book, Yes, Your Kid, What Parents Need to Know About Today's Teens and Sex, is an amazing book. I really recommend it. See, I have it right here, and I've been reading it and taking notes extensively. And, she's amazing. She's done a lot of research. A lot of what you hear quoted in the literature is from her research that focuses on women's sexual health, on population-based research, which is very important to understand how sexual behaviors are around the country. And she's published more than 200 peer-reviewed scientific articles related to sexual and reproductive health and serves as a principal investigator on the award-winning National Survey of Sexual Health and Behavior, which has been ongoing since 2009. She writes books, she researches, she's been featured New York Times, Washington Post, Vogue, Tyra Banks Show, Discovery Health, and many, 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 many more. So thank you, Dr. Herbernick, for being with us today.
Very happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yes. Yeah, so, it's interesting. I met Dr. Herbernick at the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health Conference. You guys hear me talk about Ishwish all the time as I'm on the board and I've been a prominent member for many years. And we had her come last year. I'm on the research committee. We wanted to talk about rough sex and practices. And she kind of blew my mind. Her and Dr.
Kawada.
Mm-hmm. Kawada, yes. Yeah. We went into a whole discussion on BDSM and rough sex practices. And she presented her research on, what's happening in the world of rough sex and how it impacts your overall health. So we're going to get into all that today. But, thank you, Debbie, for all the amazing work that you do. That's really been, so helpful for us as clinicians and as as parents and everything. So I want to first thank you. But, you know, can you tell me like how you kind of came about wanting to study sexual health? I think most of us, you know, have some propelling force. Like I grew up in the South and my parents were immigrants and never talked about sex in front of me ever. And so I had to learn everything on my own. And so, you know, I don't know if what journey brought you into the realm of sexual health.
Yeah, I think like many people came to study sexuality and care about sex education so passionately because nobody did talk to me about it growing up. And so, I'm a third generation American, but that conservative immigrant, lines on both sides of the family, different cultures, but like sort of British and Irish on one side and Czech on the other side, but nobody was talking about sexuality. And so, conservative Catholic families. And I think my parents would have wanted to, and I think they tried to do better than their parents did. But at the same time, it was difficult for them. So I didn't get good puberty talks growing up. My school did the very limited kind of puberty video that many, you know, fifth or sixth graders get that doesn't really say enough.
Guess what's coming to play?
And so when I graduated college, I was looking for a job and I sort of graduated a bit early in December and found a job that I could do just for a few months before I started graduate school. And that job ended up being as a research assistant for studies on sexuality and specifically on child and adolescent development. So the participants were adults, but they were reflecting on their own childhood and adolescence and, you know, the messages they got about sexuality, the family or school education, their own behaviors and development. And I realized through that project that I was just around all these people who were sexuality researchers and educators who knew so much. It became very clear to me how little I knew and that there were ways of learning more, right? That I could study it, I could learn, and I could make a career out of fulfilling or meeting that curiosity that I had about what people were doing and how they felt about it. And so I've had a 25-year career in sex research so far.
That's wonderful. Because I know we always quote some of your earlier data on like orgasms and, you know, how patients or women orgasm and some of that earlier data with just regards to like sexual behavior and the response cycle. But now you're doing some even more, I think, all your work's been compelling. I think what I've recently read, you were in the New York Times just last month about what your teenagers are learning about sex and, you know, quoted some of your research from Yes, You're a Kid, the book that you published, I think, last year, was it?
Mm-hmm. Yep, in November 2023, yeah.
So let's talk about some of the latest research. I mean, you know, sex has changed so much from us, how we absorb information. I know when I was growing up as a Gen Xer, like, you know, porn was very hard to access. Like if you wanted to, you'd sometimes get the HBO fuzzy, like where you could kind of see like, you know, some of the stuff, but like it was, you know, some people could get it from their Playboy or whatever, but, you know, sex in the media was not as prominent and as easy accessible. So, and you make a lot of that in your book, the points about how much, sexting and pornography has contributed to some of what we're seeing. So let's talk a little bit about that, and then you could tell us some of the staggering data points you mentioned in the book about what's happening and what type of sex people are having.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, and I'm a Gen Xer myself, and I can completely identify with how different access to sex and technology and pornography, but other just even representations of sexuality in media. I mean, I often give the example that, you know, if when I was a teenager, Beverly Hills 90210 was a popular show. Yeah. And my parents didn't watch it, but I watched it, my friends watched it. And if I was watching it, I had to turn it on, you know, on a TV in the house. And so even if my parents weren't watching it, they could overhear what was happening. Yeah. There was no private, you know, tablet device or phone that I could watch it on. So my media use was somewhat apparent, you know, within the family. And so parents had more access to step into the conversation. And I think here, what we see is that a lot of the, you know, the media that young people are seeing is on Twitter, it's on TikTok videos. And even if you're following your kid on Twitter or TikTok or other, you know, other social media that they're at, you're not necessarily seeing what they see. So, you know, everything, of course, like the media that we get fed is based on our viewing patterns and our and various algorithms of the tech companies. So parents may not realize there's so much on TikTok that's really about like rough sex and choking and various kinds of topics, you know, drugs, whatever the case is. And they may just be seeing like fun dances on TikTok and thinking that's a lot of what TikTok is. And they love when their kids send them TikTok dances and stuff. So they may not see this other side. And so I think, you know, not only is all of this out there and represented in the media, but many parents and educators just aren't fully aware of, you know, the depth and breadth of what tweens and teens may have access to.
And that exposure and what it represents to them on about sex, I think is very prominent. Let's talk about some of your research and, you know, some of the statistics around rough sex and how it's much more common now. I think, and you can correct me, I think you had quoted that maybe 2/3 or 67% of women, and you can verify the age range, but had, I think there were college age women who had been choked during sexual intercourse. And it was, it's that common. I mean, it was really shocking to hear this actually.
It is. And it's not a fluke. We've now conducted 4 college campus representative surveys since 2020. Mm-hmm. And we consistently find that number or a little higher. So it's kind of inching up a little bit so that by the time college women are in their senior year, somewhere closer to 80% of them would have been choked at least once. But if you look at overall, you're right, it's about 2/3 of, you know, of undergraduate and graduate students who have been choked during sex. And it's not just a college student phenomenon. So nationwide, we see that 35% of women between the ages of 18 and 24 were choked during their most recent sexual event. So that's not just ever, but that's just during the last time they hooked up or had sex with somebody. So it's not only something that many people have tried at least once, but it's something that they do often. And it's really part of many of their sexual experiences.
Right. And I have to say, you know, in the sexual medicine world, we always say, don't yuck my yum or whatever. You know, that's the phrase that we hear a lot in terms of that. And so I do want to be cognizant of the fact that there are subgroups of individuals who are into sort of rough sex and BDSM under the context of doing it in a algorithmic way, almost where they know that consent is involved, that, you know, I think that they have their safe words, you know, the people in this community, you know, have a way of expressing it and they feel comfortable with it and they love it. I think our concern around that is like, is this the exposure you're getting from popular culture? And this is what you think is the norm and what that can, what happens when it accumulates, right? So I think any kind of asphyxiation, lack of oxygenation to your brain over time, you know, it's, I think the doctor that came to Ishwish, and I forgot his name again, Dr.
K. Kawada.
Yeah, so he's one of your colleagues. I think he was mentioned in your book as well. And he also came to Ishwish to talk about, you know, or we talk about the encephalopathies that football players have and that those are, that are getting recurrent concussions and how that develops over time from recurrent asphyxiation. And the analogy that he made was like the same that can happen to people that get choked recurrently as well, right? And can you talk a little bit more about that data?
Yes, absolutely. And so, yes, Dr. Kawada and his team, he's a fantastic colleague here at the Indiana University School of Public Health and largely has studied concussions and subconcussive injuries among athletes. And so he was so generous to lend his expertise here. But what he and his team did was invite groups of women into his lab to undergo brain scans and also to have blood draws to look at blood biomarkers to show how the brain is responding to, in this case, the experience of being choked or strangled during sex. And we say strangled because even though almost everybody calls it choking, technically choking refers to the internal blockage of the airways. But strangulation is really about, you know, applying external pressure or squeezing of the neck to reduce blood flow or breathing. And so so that's why you're going to hear me sometimes say, or strangulation. We're still referring to the same behavior. Mm-hmm. But so they looked at these groups of women who had been choked or strangled 4 more times in the past month, as well as those who reported never having been choked during sex. And they found, you know, several differences between them. One of the ones that has always stuck out to me was these working memory tasks that they asked the women to do while they were in the brain scanner. And they found that both groups of these, you know, otherwise young, healthy, you know, college or graduate student women were able to arrive at the correct, you know, the correct answers. Mm-hmm. However, it was the group that had been choked or strangled recently in the past month that it took them longer to arrive at the correct answers, and they had to recruit more of the areas of their brain. So as he often describes it, their brains demonstrated, you know, there's some sense that their brains are less efficient mm-hmm. than the groups of women who had never been choked during sex. So that's certainly concerning. And you know, certainly more work needs to be done, and we're planning to do more work, and we hope other people get inspired and want to look at this area as well. But it's an important first step in understanding the extent to which there may be some cumulative impact on the brain.
And I think, the importance of understanding that if you do participate in this practice, how it can have a potentially long-term effect on you, that it's not as benign as just, you know, enjoyable sex. What is it when you talk to these individuals in these surveys, what is it that they find so compelling about choking? Like, what is the reason that most people, other than, you know, what they see in pornographic videos or they hear on songs or whatever, like, what is it that you think that most of them are saying that why they want to have it done? Or
There's a diversity of reasons. And as you mentioned, there is a subset, you know, it's actually a very small subset that is into asphyxiation or choking or strangulation. There's different kinds of asphyxiation mm-hmm. as part of kink and BDSM communities. And so reasons for wanting to do it in that capacity can be really different than in the mainstream mm-hmm. culture, where in mainstream culture, many people say, oh, it seems kinky or adventurous, or that's just how sex is, and so on. And it's kind of an expected part of sex. And so there's not necessarily a real, you know, reason for wanting to do it other than kind of identity or what you think sex is supposed to be like. And so I think one of the real challenges with that is that, again, many of those individuals have not really looked into it that much, may not know much about the risks, may not even really be asking their partner about choking them before actually doing it. So they might put a hand on their neck and then say, is this okay? Like, while their hand is still on the neck, which doesn't always give a lot of opportunity for somebody to like think about it and decide. They may feel pressured or coerced. Some people do talk about wanting to do it for the effects of low levels of oxygen in their body. So some people do experience the known effects of euphoric sensations, or kind of sometimes they'll describe it feeling like cloudy headed, or they might like another aspect of it, which is they come down a little bit while they're being choked and their oxygen levels are low. But then when they reoxygenate, the pressure comes off and they get their oxygen back, they feel a burst of energy. Mm-hmm. And so some people like that part of it. So for others, it's about, you know, power and control and trust and feeling like, you know, it's exciting and connecting that their partner trusts them enough to let them choke them. So the reasons vary, but it's definitely a new era with this many people engaging in this higher risk sexual practice.
And where does consent fall into this? I know that you've done some work on, you know, how many people actually verbally consent, or this is something that was discussed. Like you said, sometimes it happens in the heat of the moment. But I know you've done some research around consent as well, because that's a critical element here, is really that this is a mutual, you know, benefit for both parties, right? So talk to us a little bit about what you've learned about consent when it comes to this age group.
Yeah, you know, when we got into this research and started conducting interviews with people, we were very curious what consent was looking like, because again, we knew being in public health that this was a higher risk sexual practices. So we thought that perhaps people would be going through more careful or explicit consent, talking about it rather than just assuming. And that wasn't the case. Sometimes people had talked about it. Sometimes they talked about it just once, in the sense of getting together and kind of making a list, or just talking through what would the things be that you would be open to, what would you like to try. But they wouldn't necessarily talk about choking again, and they might just do it a few weeks later without bringing it up again, or without any detail, right? So people don't usually talk about the intensity, or how light or how hard or for how long, and that can really matter. So sometimes some people want to be choked, they may ask to be choked, but they did not expect that somebody was going to choke them to the point of unconsciousness. Mm-hmm. And so, so people don't always, in fact, they usually don't negotiate the details of choking, or they might be fine being choked with hands, but be very upset about being choked with a belt or some other kind of ligature without any communication or consent. And ligature is a higher risk form of choking. And so, so we found that some people describe engaging in really no verbal or you know, verbal communication about it, but they just say that they rely on the vibe or the energy in the room, which is true for some other kinds of sex too. But again, we thought maybe with this higher risk form, there would be more communication. So there's a whole lot of lack of communication or lack of detailed communication. And what we are seeing, and we hear from college campuses, I regularly hear from people in Title IX offices and sexual violence prevention folks and legal systems who see these cases very often where people have agreed to hook up or have sex. They've consented to that, and that part is fine. Mm-hmm. But what they didn't consent to was either being choked or hit or smothered or something else, or they didn't consent to the level or the degree of being choked that ended up happening.
That's very surprising, actually. And I know you mentioned even, you know, that some in the book also how when discussing with some of the college kids about sexual assault and, you know, having some, I think some lawyers, you know, come talk about these cases, mm-hmm. how that actually like opened up some of their minds. Like they're like, oh, this is like I'm teetering on this sexual assault thing. Can you speak to some of the involvement of your other authors in your book and everything?
Yeah, I was so fortunate to have Susan Stone and Christina Supler join in as contributors to Yes, Your Kid. And they are two attorneys who see cases around sexual misconduct and sexual assault all the time. So they really deal with these cases all over the United States. And they guest lectured in my class. And it was very eye-opening for my students to really think through the real-life implications of some of their behaviors. Anything from learning that, for example, it can be intimidating to, you know, stand between somebody and the door, right? Or to lock the door and stuff, and that somebody might feel trapped. Like some of them hadn't really thought through those power dynamics mm-hmm. and that those can be seen as pressuring or, you know, pressuring somebody or coercing or kind of be intimidating to needing to talk or needing to talk more than just text. So many young people find it so much easier to talk with a partner or a potential partner about what they're into over text. And that makes a lot of sense. A lot of people feel more comfortable having those digital conversations. But what's so important, and what Christina and Susan said, you know, they had seen in so many of their cases, is that that's where the conversation not just started, but ended for too many yeah. of them. And so, you know, so in Yes, Your Kid, for example, we talked about the importance of really making sure once you're physically in the same place that you again check in with what you feel like doing with each other that day and what, you know, and again, how it feels and what you want to do and what limits or boundaries might be, or if something is higher risk, safe words or safe gestures that you might use, but not just relying on text or message conversations.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the biggest things that's changed for us Gen Xers, right? Is that, you know, there used to be so much accountability when it came to like meeting people and dating, and because it was always face to face, or you know, you knew some of their friends or family members, and it was something that you there's just that human sort of value of being around somebody and speaking to them in person, where you can see how what you say affects them, right? Versus like, I'm just going to text you to F off and like, you know, whatever, you know, and they don't know how it affects them because they don't see that communication. And I think that's changed dramatically. That's changed the dating world. That's changed how we, you know, how people find people to marry all the time. And I feel like, and you could say this as a whole, that how social media, how, you know, these devices have affected relationships in general, right? But I think it's really had a dramatic impact on sexual relationships.
Absolutely, it has. And so it's very important, again, to think about like those real life conversations and how much they matter for consent, for seeing how, you know, people's reaction to you and treating them as human beings and not just words on a screen.
Right, because we all know, I mean, all of us have some social media presence, and it's very easy for someone to troll you and tell you that X, Y, or Z. And you just have to be like, okay, this, I'm a human being, like you to realize that. Yeah, and I also like the chapter that you did on, you know, individuals that are on the spectrum. That was very interesting because yeah. I don't feel like, and we had someone talk about this at Ishwish this year too, sex on the spectrum. Mm-hmm. So I like that you brought that up. Can you speak to a little bit about your chapter on that? Because I feel like, you know, we do see, you know, so many people that are neurodivergent, you know, they're not as understood, and potentially communication becomes an issue for some of them. But let's
Yeah. So I used to work with kids who are on the autism spectrum for quite a few years and really, really loved that mm-hmm. work. But at the time, you know, there was almost no, you know, support for parents in terms of dealing with sexuality education or puberty education. So it's been an area of research that's really grown over the years. And there's a lot more educational programs. We also have many more autistic students on college campuses than we used to, and at least who feel comfortable, you know, talking about that. We have more support and on our college campuses mm-hmm. in terms of like student accessibility offices. So we do have more autistic students. So that's also changed the dynamics of my classroom. Mm-hmm. I have many more students who tell me that they're autistic, who may talk about some of the, you know, the challenges that they experience in their sexual life. And we've had more autistic students as part of our research studies who share about you know, their needs, their curiosities, communication issues. And in the realm of, you know, both just sort of general sexuality and connecting to my work on rough sex, I mean, one of the things that's been so interesting to me and we've seen emerge in the research is so many more, you know, young autistic adults who talk about having interests in kink and BDSM, and for different reasons. And sometimes it's related to social interactions and communication and really, really appreciating the principles that are often part of BDSM or kink communities around having explicit negotiation and conversation, because then you're not relying on kind of these unwritten nonverbal cues that so many, you know, of people in society go by, because things are laid out so they can really appreciate that there's going to be a lot of communication and it will be clear to them and to other people. Sometimes people who are autistic also really appreciate and enjoy a lot of the sensory issues that are, again, very openly available. And people talk about a much broader range of like the sex menu, if you will, in kink and BDSM communities. So they might say like, oh, I really want some like sensory deprivation, or actually I really want harder impact. And here's people who are open to lots of possibilities. So, you know, I did write a little bit about that, because sometimes we do hear from parents who say, you know, I've got a 16 or 17 year old autistic, you know, son, and I found this porn that they're watching and it's really focused on all this kink stuff and I'm trying to understand it. Mm-hmm. And although there's lots of different reasons that kid may be watching that, and some of it's just because that's what's out there on websites these days, sure. Some of it also may be related to the experience of being autistic as well and to sensory issues. So whether it's that side of things or even just more general sexuality education, you know, I think writing that chapter was really fun and interesting for me. And, you know, I talked with some of my students and other adults who I know on the spectrum. But, you know, even thinking about things like the importance of using very clear language and not relying on vague euphemisms, I mean, that should be for everybody, yeah. Right? But often sex education is people talking about like notches on the belt, yeah. Or sleeping with somebody.
Yeah.
And really, everybody does better when we have frank, clear communication.
Right.
But that is especially important for autistic kids and tweens and teens who really, really need to not be guessing what people mean by kind of, you know, sort of beating around the bush with their language.
Yeah. No, I love that you did that, because it is so much more common, and it's probably not talked about as much as it should be in terms of like how patients or, you know, parents or anyone that is neurodivergent, like how do you sort of help navigate, you know, sexuality for them, you know, and you know, we know there's a big spectrum, and so it can vary in terms of what you need and what they need. But I love that you incorporated that, because I think that that is often missed by a lot of people who talk about sexual education.
Yeah.
And, you know, you also talk a little bit about sexting and, you know, how that looks in terms of, you know, people that, how that can impact relationships. I feel like that is something that is, you know, can get people into a lot of trouble when, you know, I think that, you know, do you want to talk a little bit about what you found out about just sexting in general?
Yeah. And I think to take a step back, I would say really just about taking and sharing nudes. And so, you know, we Gen Xers often call it sexting. You know, as I mentioned in the book, you know, young people just talk about like nudes and stuff like that. So, but I still lean on the language of sexting as well because of, you know, my generation. But and of course, and I mentioned taking and sharing of nudes too, because it's I think it's bigger than just sexting and sharing texts and messages. And I think so one thing that all tweens and teens, anyone with a phone, access to a connected device, you know, really good information for parents to give to their kids is not to take or share nude images, not to ask other people for nude images. Mm-hmm. We find that even some elementary age kids are being pressured to send nudes, especially girls are often on the receiving end of that pressure. So one thing that some parents can even do is check out the policies in their school system. Mm-hmm. And if the only people who get in trouble are the ones who are sharing the nude image, they should also talk to their school about revising policy mm-hmm. to be about asking or pressuring other people for nude images. So looking at the upstream behavior, because a major reason that people, especially, again, girls, are sending images is because they're being pressured and hounded for them, or they feel like it's the only way they're going to get someone's interest and attention. Mm-hmm. Young people also need to know that in many states that, you know, these nude images of minors will be treated as child pornography or as image-based sexual abuse. So even if it's just you and your dating partner and you're the same age and you're both 15 or 16, in some states, it just doesn't matter. And so, in fact, in most states, it's going to get you into some kind of trouble. There are very few places in the U.S. where truly consensual, non-coerced sexting is not a problem. And so most of the time, it could at least lead to school suspensions or expulsions. And of course, you know, the principal seeing these images, I spoke with one woman whose dad was a middle school principal, and she said, you know, it's just been so upsetting for him over the years to have to see sometimes images of his students. He doesn't want to look at these pictures. He doesn't want to have to get the police involved, but he has to, right? He has to do these things as part of his job. So also many of us who are professionals in this space could be advocating more for decriminalizing, you know, these images of consensual, non-coerced, non-pressured images so that fewer kids have to go through those systems, mm-hmm. right? And have police and judges and lawyers and principals and everyone looking at that. I think these days, what we really worry about too, though, are these AI-generated images. And we've seen lots of headlines, you know, in the past, really even in just the past few months, they've exploded, where middle schoolers and high schoolers have been charged with, you know, with creating deep fake or AI-generated images, nude images of their classmates. And in some cases, all they've done is friended somebody on Instagram, gotten one or two, you know, images off that student's Instagram with fully clothed, put them into an app or an AI type of program, and then they take and share and, you know, and pass around images of this classmate that looks like they're completely nude. So some states, fortunately, have quickly worked to enact laws, but not all of them have that. So in some of these states, families have no recourse or very limited recourse. And so that's changing. There's also a federal bill that has been proposed. It's not passed yet, to my knowledge. But again, as technology keeps changing, you know, we need to be aware of this. And so for parents with tweens and teens, you know, they need to know not only don't take or send, you know, nude images, but don't make them of other people. Like, and talk with them about what that could do to somebody else. And you don't want to hurt your friends. You don't want to, you know, be seen as the creepy person at school who's doing this. And you don't want to get our family in trouble and have to pay thousands of dollars in legal fees and all of these other things. So really just, you know, I would say, and it's not to scare anyway, you know, as I say throughout, yes, your kid, I'm not trying to scare you, but I am trying to prepare you. So it's not about scaring folks, but do talk with your kids. And, you know, what a lot of research finds with parenting, whether it's about drugs or alcohol or sexting, is that a warm informational approach is very effective. It's not too strict. It's not too passive and lenient, but like caring about your kids, saying, I want you to know this. I want you to know the laws in our state. You know, you've got to know school policy. Mm-hmm. So, you know, here are the things, like, here's what I think, you know, you should or shouldn't do, but also don't ever make your kid feel like they're doomed. Yes. Because we always want our kids to feel like they can come to us, because sometimes things don't go according to plan, right? But they still need our support.
Yeah, absolutely. I have to say, yeah, I mean, obviously there's some statistics in the book that are scary, and it's just scary to learn about how things have changed from our generation. But you do give a lot of great advice about communicating with your child about, you know, even starting as early as, you know, pre-puberty. I was telling you earlier that I give the puberty talks at my school for my kids' school. And, you know, this is where my daughter at at 10 realize what I do for a living. And she was like, really appalled. Like, this is what you do. But, you know, I think it was very important for me to just know what they're learning in a correct fashion. And, you know, like, the vulva is the vulva, the vagina is the vagina. You have to say the right terms. And even one of the teachers were like, I had no idea it was vulva, like, and she was like 40 years old or something like that. So it was very interesting to do these talks at my kid's school. But I have to say that, you know, I've been going to Ishwish, you know, maybe for the last, you know, 9 years or something. And when my kids were smaller, I would always take them to the conferences with me because I didn't have, you know, someone to watch over them necessarily the whole time. So they would try to, like, what is this sex stuff here? You know, and at the time, I, you know, growing up, child of immigrants, didn't talk about sex. I adapted what my parents would say, like, don't talk about it. Like, just don't worry about it. This is not for you. Like, this is what I would tell them initially. Then after reading your book and after, like, coming to terms with it on my own, because it is something that even though I try to fight my own, you know, like, you know, what my own upbringing, right? Like, even though I talk to my patients about it very openly, I give talks all over the country about sexual medicine and sex and all this stuff. But when it comes to your own kids, you were very, like, a little, still a little bit hard to do. And so, you know, after reading your book and hearing what you said at the conference, I just, you know, and I've talked to my kids about puberty ad nauseum, but, like, the actual sex stuff. So I really just sat my 14-year-old down and I was just like, look, I gave you a phone last year for the good or the bad. You're not on social media. I get it. But I know that you've been, you know, probably scrolled and you might have seen something that, you know, is considered pornographic. Let's talk about it. And he's like, well, Mom, I mean, you know, if I did, I didn't watch it. I don't want you to think I'm watching pornography. And I'm like, no, I get it. But I want you to understand that it's okay to talk to me about it because I want you to get the right information from me and understand sort of, you know, the things around sex and consent and, you know, where we stand, you know, and where we, you know, where I want you to be in terms of, like, relationships and, you know, with other individuals. I mean, I just wanted them to realize that they can come to me, you know? So it was interesting for them because they were like, I said, you know what I do, right? Like, you guys see my PowerPoints all the time and it's the topics that you don't ever talk to me about, but this is what I want you to know that you can talk to me about. So I think, you know, even after hearing you and reading your book, it really forced me. Like, I got to have this conversation. So I appreciate that, actually. And I was telling you also that I appreciated the fact that, like, now when I talk to my patients who have sexual dysfunction, I do always try to, you know, talk about what sexual practices they're involved with so they can be aware of some of these issues around, like, asphyxiation and choking and strangulation.
Yeah. And of course, I always love hearing when parents decide to expand their conversations with their kids after reading Yes, Your Kid. I mean, that is so affirming. Like, that's why I wrote the book. And I also love, you know, hearing that you're talking with your patients because so many of them really don't understand the risks of being choked. We've done some research looking at the media articles online and the social media memes, and they really just portray it as, you know, not that harmful, or there are safe ways to do it. And, you know, we talked about some of the potential cumulative risks on cumulative effects on the brain, but there's even, like, the carotid arteries, right? And so potentially damaging the arteries in the neck. So this idea that, oh, it's safe, just only, you know, only touch the sides, not the trachea, not the windpipe, is not the case. And I've already heard from some clinicians who have seen carotid artery dissection in patients who have come in, and you know, had emergency situations, right? And so, and we know that happens, and it's rare, but it can happen. And now that so many people are doing it, it's concerning. And certainly in, like, OB-GYN, I mean, we also need to be thinking about pregnant people,
right?
You know, who are lowering the oxygen in their body and in their blood system, you know, by engaging in choking and so on, and what that could possibly do to, you know, to fetal development. So I think just asking those questions gives an opening for a conversation to have all of those. What I think clinicians are so good at, mm-hmm. too, is taking in sometimes some really difficult information and figuring out how to provide, like, again, like, at least in my experience, I feel like calm, steady, yeah. You know, fact-based information, but that, you know, really supports the person having enough information to make a choice for themselves that supports their health. Yeah. And they may not get that advice from anyone else in their world. And, you know, I know I even recently saw someone who's around my age, an old friend, and she said, you know, I have to tell you, I stopped engaging in choking because I heard you on someone's podcast. Oh, what? And she said, you know, you and that person were talking, and she said, I, you know, didn't want to do this, but the person I was dating had, you know, reassured me it was completely safe. So we had been doing it for a while. And after I heard, you know, you and this other person on their podcast, and you both were saying, no, this, you know, this actually has some risks to it. I sort of went to him and said, you know, it's not as safe as I think you thought it was. And I don't want to do this anymore. Right. So just having that information can give people the tools they need to figure out what's right for them.
Right. And at least then, I mean, it's kind of like just informed consent, right? Like we talk mm-hmm. about it all the time in procedures that we do, like we don't anticipate these things or we don't want these things to happen, but it is a possibility, right? Like we, you know, when you start someone on birth control pills, you might tell them that you might develop sexual pain or, you know, low libido. And that's a risk, but you have to know your risks going in. You can't think that you're right, that this is a safe, you know, practice that's not going to impact, you know, my quality of life or my cognition or any of that. And I think that's the key. And if you're willing to take the risk, that's your thing. That's what you have to, but I do like that you've gotten information out there. I mean, even, I know you talk about that song by Jack Harlow. I hear my, I was listening to my daughter sing it one day and I'm like, do you know what he's talking about? When I don't like those whips and chains, you know, like, let's talk about the song. And she was like, Mom, not right. I was like, well, you're singing, like, put your loving on me. Let's talk about what that means, you know? And she was like, oh, God, Mom. She wasn't ready for it.
It's a teachable moment, you know? It is. And at least she knows you're there for the conversation and that it might give her, you know, something to think about. And I know many of us can probably remember singing along to certain, you know, Madonna songs or other things, you know, that look like, we're like, oh, did we really know what that meant? But, you know, but I think
stalker songs, there are so many stalker songs.
There were, right? Like, and so I think, you know, I do tell people often with parents there's upsides and downsides to how pervasive choking and rough sex is in the media these days. And certainly the downsides are just the normalization of it, especially without communication, consent, or really awareness of the true risks. But the upside is that it means you have so many places to step into those conversations. If you hear them singing Lovin' on Me, you know, you can bring it up. If you know that they've seen pornography, talk about it. Yeah. Or, you know, so, I mean, you have options. You have a lot of ways in other than just kind of a random awkward sit down. You know, it's you can connect with your kids over the media.
Right. You can sing with them and then they just get really disturbed by the fact that you're singing the song.
Yeah. If you really don't want them to like that song, just sing with them.
Well, I mean, I think everyone should get this book. Yes, Your Kid. It is a wonderful book, especially if you're in the sexual health realm, if you have kids, if you know kids, if you have any idea, if you're practicing any of the rough sex practices we talked about, just to get more information for yourself. Because like I say here, I'm here to educate so you could advocate for yourself. And it's whether or not it's advocating for yourself in the healthcare realm or advocating for yourself with your partner. You know, you have to know what the impact is on your body. So thank you once again, Dr. Herbernack. I really appreciate you being here. I love what you're doing. I can't wait to see all the new data that, you know, you guys are working on. So, and then you can come back and tell me about
it. Thanks for having me.
Thanks again, guys. This has been Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. Again, I'm here to educate so you can advocate. Please join us again next week for another great episode. If you have a second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear. To get more information, my practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.